Thank you for tuning into Artsy's Diner Radio, the voice of artsysdiner.com. And now, our feature presentation.
Thank you for joining Artsy's Diner Radio Network, the voice of artsysdiner.com. Artsy's Diner Radio Network brings you musicians, artists, authors, thinkers, dreamers from all over the world. Artsy's Diner is that special little virtual diner now going on its sixth year. Like a fine wine, it is getting better with time. So pull up a chair, grab that favorite beverage, sit back and enjoy the show. Artsy's Diner, changing the world one song at a time, one heart at a time. And now, the host of our show.
Together with Patrick Blessinger, as we're going to continue our conversation that we started 3 weeks ago about meaning-centered education. And I'm so delighted that Patrick is going to be with us today. He is the founder of HETL, which is the Higher Education Teaching and Learning. And he has been working on global education. His new book is a collection of essays, Meaning-Centered Education. And we are just so excited because through this we are learning about a global understanding of education and how we all can move together to create a greater understanding and diversity in education. Now, when we speak of diversity in education, we're not talking about your standard diversity as we discussed 3 weeks ago. It identifies the multiple different ways in which we can share content and understand the learner a little bit better. So anyway, I'm bringing on the air now Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, it's perfect. Thank you for having
Excellent.
Me.
Excellent. Oh, I'm so glad that you're here. We had some great, I could not hear anything, but I knew it was running. So I thought, well, so we had to do some quick switch here and literally we had to dial back it again. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So how have you been in these 3 weeks since we last talked?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I've been doing good. It's been raining all day here in New York City, so I hope we don't get any thunderstorms or anything like that, because I'm on Skype, too. And so, you know, with technology, it's both good and bad. It's great when it's all working, but when it's not working, then it's not so good.
Exactly. So we'll talk again soon, we'll talk for as long as we can and get in as much information as we can, and then, you know, it'll be a nice addition to what we already started. And so we left off really getting into the concept of what meaning-centered education is and how it applies to kind of the looking at things from the top down and from the bottom up, and, you know, and how to establish this continuum so that we know that those children who are entering into higher education are truly, number one, ready to continue on with meaning-centered education, but most importantly, to really have a good experience. So many people say that when they go to college that, well, you know, I really didn't learn anything. And you go, wait a minute, how could you not emerge as questioning ever, you know, having more questions about the world and attempting to, you know, tackle that. So anyway, so that's my two cents for the night, for whatever it's worth. And I really just want to turn it over to you and let you, you know, share with us what's going on with, number one, with higher education, teaching, and learning. You know, what's on the horizon. And also, let's talk about what meaning-centered education is.
Yeah. Well, you know, as probably everyone is aware, not only in this country, but in countries the world over, education is undergoing seismic shifts in the nature of education and all the different aspects of education. And not just at the K through 12 level, but at the higher education level also. In fact, you know, some would argue that education at K through 12 level, you know, is universal. Modern societies have adopted by and large this principle of universal education at the K through 12 level for probably, you know, over a century now. And so we've been working on universal education at the K through 12 level for a long time now, for well over 100 years, and in the U.S. probably 150 years. And during that period, education at the K through 12 level has undergone a lot of different reforms, and it continues to go through different phases and different reforms as education becomes more important in people's lives. It becomes more important in society because we've moved from, you know, an industrial based society to a post-industrial based society, what a lot of people, you know, call the knowledge society or the creative society that we now live in. And what that implies is that education and learning is really at the front and center of our focus as human beings and as a society. And so it's taken on a greater importance in our lives, both at a social level and at an individual level, than at any other time in human history. And so we've seen this play out at K through 12 level by the expansion of basic primary and secondary education to everyone in society. And now, so the notion of universal education, education for everyone, regardless of one's ability, regardless of one's talents, regardless of one's background, is a right, is a fundamental human right, you know, up until, you know, a person reaches 18, you know, which in most societies is considered, you know, sort of the age of you know, adulthood, or, you know, being legally an adult anyhow. But now, you know, as we move into the 21st century, because knowledge is so important, and it continues to take on an increasingly important element in our lives, both socially and individually, we're now seeing this notion of universal education being applied to the higher education level as well. Not so much as a fundamental human right, you know, as applied to the K through 12 level, but simply because of the reality of the times that we live in, you know, as human beings. And, you know, the pace of change, and there are several, you know, reasons for that. Knowledge, you know, as I said earlier, has and will continue to take on an increasingly important aspect in human lives, both economically, politically, and in every dimension we can think of. And so education, ongoing education and ongoing learning in today's world just seems like a basic sort of requirement for people to stay engaged in, you know, through their entire lives. So now getting, you know, the old sort of notion, because I'm, you know, I'll be 50 in a few months, and so I can, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so I've seen, you know, had the benefit of seeing a lot of changes, you know, in those years. I come from a very working class family, working class, blue collar background. My father was growing up, for example, he grew up during the Great Depression. And in the Great Depression, there wasn't a strong incentive for, you know, most people to go on to college or university like there is today. The focus back then, the Great Depression, as you can imagine, was just on, you know, providing for your family and providing for the basic necessities of life. And he did that very well. But now we live in a much different age, a much different time. And just within the last several, you know, few generations, last several decades, just in the last two generations, in fact, we've seen radical changes in how society functions, how the economy functions, and the demands and the requirements that that puts on people, you know, in today, in the year 2013. And so it's no surprise, therefore, that education and higher education in particular has taken on a greater focus and a greater importance in people's lives. And so, you know, over the last 100 years, we've seen, as I said before, you know, the expansion of K through 12 education being applied to everyone, you know, universally.
Right.
We're starting to see that. Actually, we've seen it since World War II with the you could even make a case for going back to the 1864 with the Morrell Act, which created the land-grant universities in the U.S. And then that was really the first concrete act where the whole notion of, you know, making higher education available to a wider portion of society really took, you know, a concrete step. Because
yeah,
it established...
I was just going to, you know, to throw this out there that, you know, when our fathers were in school, you know, there was this situation where the jobs that they could do to support their family did not require high degrees of literacy. And now we are in a phase where, you know, there are multiple different types, there are multiple forms of literacy, even on the earliest with our youngest children. It used to be, you know, we would focus on the three R's. And, you know, and then as kids got older, they started getting deeper and deeper into multiple types, forms of content. But, I mean, I don't recall ever having set aside lessons of social studies until I was at least in the fifth grade. And now we talk about, you know, integrating. And so we start talking about multiple forms of literacy, and there's so much coming at our kids at such a rapid rate. And now we are in a situation where almost without advanced education, you know, moving beyond high school, whether it be a training or, you know, degrees, it's almost impossible to even get the simplest of jobs. So how... you know, have we begun to see to some degree some level of teaching without even meaning? It's just to, you know, we've got to do it, so let's get it done. I mean, are you sensing that at all in your conversations?
Well, in the higher education space in particular, we're seeing, you know, huge changes occurring in both the teaching area and the learning area. Really, I mean, in every area, actually. But with the work that I'm focused on with HEDL and the book in particular, the Meaning-Centered Education book, we focused primarily on the teaching and learning aspects of education. Because in looking at education, the core process, the most fundamental process that defines what education is all about is the teaching-learning process. So when you strip away the administrative overhead and you know, all the stuff that is used to support, you know, the fundamental activities and fundamental processes of education, what you're left with is the teaching-learning process. And so that was one of the reasons why in creating the group HEDL, for example, that's what I wanted to focus on, was, and why we called it Higher Education Teaching Learning, because I wanted to focus on the teaching learning process, because that's the most fundamental central process that the educational endeavor, you know, is all about. That's what defines the key definition, defining element of education is teaching and learning. And so understanding that, therefore, you know, becomes critically important, very important. So it was the basis for, you know, the focus and the aims and the mission of the HEDA group. But when we decided to work on the meaning-centered education book, we wanted to take a fresh look at, and as you recall from our last conversation, it was a two-year process of doing research and really doing as exhaustive of a study and analysis of the different aspects of teaching, the different aspects of learning, and trying to make, you know, better sense of all that. Because there is, I think, for a lot of people, even in higher education, even for educators, for professors and instructors, there is still, I think, some confusion. And this is based on, you know, my conversations with many thousands of educators and my participation in many online communities and listservs and discussion groups. Still a lot of confusion, you know, about, you know, what is the just basic fundamental questions, like what is the purpose of education? You know, what is the ultimate purpose? There's still debate around that fundamental question. And so when we set out, you know, the task of working on this book, that's where we had to start because it made the most sense to start there, you know, asking the basic fundamental questions, questions that have been asked for, you know, 2,500 years, you know, since the days of Plato and Socrates and Aristotle all the way through the modern times. And so those are the kind of questions that we had to, you know, that we focused on. What is the fundamental purpose of education? And because that will drive, you know, depending on your answer to those, you know, fundamental questions, will determine or at least greatly influence your view of education and what it should, you know, look and feel like and how it should behave and what should the, you know, outcomes, the ultimate outcomes of educational or education, you know, produce. And in doing our research and looking at, you know, all the different schools of thought and the history and the evolution of education and learning, you know, over the last 2,500 years, but really focusing mainly on the last 100 years or so, you know, we came to some conclusions, you know, about that that are outlined in the book. And then from that, we're able to also look at, you know, the perspectives from educators in other countries, you know, in the UK and Australia and other places. Because the book is an edited book, so it has about a dozen different authors, you know, over 13 chapters, and so we looked at it from a multi. We looked at, you know, looking at these basic questions from multiple perspectives, and then our attempt was to, you know, okay, how do we connect the dots? How do we make the connections? You know, from these various perspectives. And so that's what we attempted to do in the last chapter, where we were able to define the basic concepts and principles and learning activities that really define, that we feel define meaning-centered education and meaning-centered learning. But in the beginning of the book, we had to, you know, really make a very rigorous effort to first define, you know, address those fundamental questions. You know, what is teaching? What is education? What is learning? What is the difference between, you know, these ideas and these activities? What is pedagogy? You know, pedagogy, you know, we hear that term tossed around a lot, but basically that's, you know, really just a, if you want to simplify it, it's a fancy word for teaching, you know. So pedagogy is just teaching.
And, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and that was a hard task to do because, one, we wanted to produce a scholarly book, you know, that was based on a rigorous research methodology and academic research approach. But at the same time, we wanted to make it accessible to as many people as possible, not just academics, but even, you know, just anyone who has an interest in this area, and make it accessible to people who've never, you know, studied learning theory or teaching or had any courses in that, or who may not even be, you know, teachers or professional instructors. And so we had to put it in a language that hopefully, you know, and this was, I guess, the task of any author, you know, who is writing, you know, a book of this type, is to try to articulate it, you know, and put it in a language in such a way that, you know, is acceptable, accessible, you know, to anyone, you know. Now, whether or not we've done that, I don't know. But you know, hopefully as more people read it, I will, you know, get some, you know, feedback from that. And
right. Well, I think it is. I think your book is very accessible. I like the way that it is broken down. And, you know, from the perspective of, you know, being in education and also seeing so many changes in education, much like yourself. I mean, I'm 52, so I was just a little bit older than you. And, you know, so I, you know, what was expected of kids graduating from school in 1978 as compared to what's expected right now. And then there's this huge divide because most of us who graduated from school we're just between 78 and, you know, 1983, thereabouts, whatever. Our kids are now entering into higher education. And so we are still, but yet there have been so many advances. And I know there's one thing in the very beginning of the book, it says, today's learners belong to a generation that is confronted with many challenges and changes brought about by the post-industrial age. Well, we are in an even different age. And I mean, we're in post-technology boom day.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so the question becomes, what happens when education itself, the institutions that are still born out of this concept, the teacher funnels the information to the students because most of them are coming to the classroom with little to no experience beyond helping their father and mother with the farms. And so at that point, it was a one-way street. You had this person in the front of the classroom who was all-knowing, delivered the information. Kids went away. My father never went past eighth grade. My mother was, you know, unfortunately had to stay home and take care of her father when her mother died when she was only 15.
Yeah, my parents were exactly the same for my parents also.
So, I mean, which was very, it wasn't that uncommon. And so now we're in a point where we are still continuing in many cases, not all, but in many cases, especially in our American schools, I'll speak to that, you still have teacher in front of the classroom delivering the information. Student is now has this multiplicity that they're coming to the classroom with, and they in some cases might know more in regards to technology depending on what they've studied at home. And so you know, so there, when you have a school system, which is what I believe in many cases we have, where you still have nothing but a chalkboard and you still have a teacher with the same books that are maybe, you know, a decade old. And, you know, kid sits there, writes down the answers, goes home, and that's where there is no meaning that's taken place. You know, there isn't. And so how do, or rather, I think that this book answers very well how do we move forward and catch up in some regards. And maybe we don't, maybe we're not even at the point where we should try catching up. Sometimes you just have to just do and go right from where you're at in a way. And, you know, I'm seeing all these buzzwords, critical. We have to teach our kids how to think critically. And I'm thinking back to, wait a minute, my father was one of the most logical, critical, analytic people that you will ever meet. And he never went past eighth grade.
Yeah.
You know, so what was different about him compared to the average kid? And why or do we feel as though we're not doing that? Or what do you think?
Well, I mean, what you just outlined is spot on, you know, because when you look at education, you know, whether it's at the K-12 level or the higher education level, you basically have two, to simplify it, you know, you have two basic approaches. And in fact, I just watched a before, you know, the program started here today, I watched a wonderful YouTube interview of Noam Chomsky, who's one of the leading, you know, sort of educational philosophers and social commentators. He's a professor at MIT and did a beautiful job of outlining this also. And it's a YouTube video. It's called Education for Whom and for What by Noam Chomsky. And you know, there are two basic approaches. You outlined one very well, and that is the traditional approach, which is basically, you know, it's like filling an empty vessel. It's the, you know, the tabula rasa, filling an empty, you know, a pot with water, you know, and that assumes that the, and that's the traditional method, what I call the spoon feeding method of education,
right.
Where you have, and what that does, and the reason I call it the spoon feeding method is because to some degree, you know, it does tend to infantilize students by not putting enough responsibility on them to take responsibility for their own learning. And what it does is when you have a situation where the teacher is, where it's a one-way communication, and the teacher is locked into, you know, one mode of usually a lecture, you know, with you know, of delivering information, and the students never have an opportunity to participate in the process because they're, you know, being told you need to sit there and listen to what I have to say, take notes, and then I'll give you a test, you know, at midterm or at the end of the term to see how much of this you've remembered, okay?
Right.
And everyone's familiar with that. I'm sure everyone, you know, regardless of what subjects they've taken, you know, has experienced that, you know, very sort of teacher-centric traditional mode of instruction. And but now, and there's been all sorts of, you know, research that has been done, especially in the last couple of generations, especially in the last 10, 20 years, that shows if you're and there's nothing inherently, you know, wrong with lecture or teaching, you know, if it's used in limited ways to, you know, explain difficult concepts and to build the foundation, what we call scaffolding, okay? But if that becomes the only or the sole mode of the educational process, then you whether you realize it or not, consciously or unconsciously, you create a situation where you turn students into, you know, passive, you know, people in the process. And if educational research and learning research has shown, it's anything, it's demonstrated that the most effective learning happens when the learner is actively engaged in the process,
right,
and they take greater increasing amounts of ownership over their own learning process and responsibility over their own learning process. And when they do that, they become more academically motivated, you know,
right,
to want to learn. And so you move from a sort of a spoon-feeding method approach, you know, which is the traditional way, to a paradigm. You shift the paradigm where the focus is not so much on teaching, but it's on learning.
Right.
So learning becomes the sort of the central activity that's driving the whole educational process. And it starts with defining, you know, what, and that really becomes, you know, the defining element of education, you know, the ultimate purpose of education, which we talked about at the beginning of the interview, you know, and that is the ultimate purpose of education is to produce learning. Learning for everyone who's involved in the process, primarily the students, but also learning within the teacher. So it becomes more dynamic. So learning becomes the outcome, and learning becomes the process. So the focus is on defining, you know, the learning outcomes, and then and that's going to be contextual, because what learning outcomes one defines is going to, you know, be different for each course. So the learning outcomes you define for a physics course, for example, may be, you know, different than the learning outcomes you define for a humanities course or an art course, because they're fundamentally different courses.
Right.
They use different modes of inquiry. And so the whole idea of contextualism, you know, understanding the context of the learning situation becomes very, very important. But it all centers around learning, you know. So education can therefore be viewed as a learning community. And when you look at education and educational institutions, regardless of the level, whether it's primary, secondary, or tertiary, the institution now starts to function like a learning community where the focus is on learning and learning as an outcome, learning as a process. And then that mind shift from a teacher sort of centric or teaching centric view to a learning and a learner centric view totally changes the dynamics of what education is all about and how it's viewed. And so this is when we were doing the research for the book, this is what emerged, this understanding and these different paradigms is what emerged from the, you know, from the research that we did and the findings in the book, and what we've then were able to, in the last chapter, articulate what the core principles of you know, effective learning should be, and core concepts and core activities.
And I appreciate that you do that, because one of the things that I encounter time and time again when I'm doing professional development with teachers, whatever, is that they all say, you know what, we really want meaning-centered learning. They might not use that terminology, but that's what they're suggesting.
Sure.
We really want a learning center. We really want to know and to do what we know instinctively and what we were taught as we were becoming educators, and we are bound and tied to these things. We're bound and tied to a textbook. We're bound and tied to our pacing guides. Depending on your district, they might be called something different. And we are bound and tied to standardized testing. And increasingly, you would think that we would be moving, the more we know about meaning-centered learning, rich learning communities, diversity in approaches to education. We are becoming more and more straddled by those three things. And, you mm-hmm. know, so textbooks are wonderful when they are used as a secondary resource. I had a principal my first year of teaching said, none of my teachers, I don't want to see you reflecting what pages, and I don't want to open up your lesson book or your lesson plan and see that all you've done is spewed back what a textbook says you should do. That is to mm-hmm. be used as a secondary. In fact, she wouldn't, you know, she was, you know, hell-bent on that concept. And right. I learned so much because of that. And then as I progressed onward, you know, and I started hearing more and more, well, we have to get through this today.
Yeah.
Even if there was meaningful conversations and proper and opportunities, it was mm-hmm. we must get through this today because tomorrow I have to be started on the next page of the pacing guide, and if I'm not, and my curriculum director comes in here, I'm going to be in deep doo doo. So, mm-hmm. you know, what are or how do you see Hedel taking that and beginning to educate, since the majority of all learning takes place between the teacher and the learner? How are we going to be moved to the point where we begin to actually empower that process and turn it around? Because what's happening is that power is being diminished. And I don't even like to use the word power because it's not about one person or another. But,
right.
you know, so how are we going to see that trickle down? And what are you seeing in higher education, which is suggesting that that is going to be transforming education on the earlier levels?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it is a difficult transition, you know, especially if
yeah.
you are used to doing, you know, facilitating education, you know, in the traditional way, where, you know, you go into a classroom and you lecture for 50 minutes or an hour, and none of the students say anything because, you know, they're required to just sit there and be quiet and take notes, you know. To shift, and in that mode, you know, the teacher is basically just a content expert, you know, a subject matter expert. And I don't want to diminish that, you know, role, because obviously, you know, teachers need to be content experts. They need to be subject matter experts. But when the educational environment limits their role to only doing that, then mm-hmm. you create, I think, a learning environment that is very stifled, you know, and not very effective. And because the students, the learners, which, you know, is supposed to be the center, you know, of the teaching-learning process and why we're all there, are not actively engaged in the learning process. But for a teacher to, you know, make that mind shift to adopting a learner-centered or learning-centered approach can be very difficult, you know, especially if they're used to doing it just one way and they've been doing that for 20 or 30 years, and worse yet, if the particular environment or institution that they're in encourages that and even rewards that, so there may be even less of an incentive to, you know, want to, you know, shift the paradigm. So, you know, these are – they're. You know, I would imagine that some teachers and at the K-12 level and instructors at the higher ed level, you know, probably in a difficult position if they're, you know, if they find themselves in that situation. But, you know, and that was one of the reasons why, you know, I started the group, the Hedel group, was because I was just convinced that, you know, the best way to help facilitate a paradigm shift that is based on the latest research and what we know about learning and how, you know, effective learning works and should work. The best way to, you know, facilitate that, you know, is through a grassroots effort by bringing individual teachers and professors and instructors of all institutions at all levels together to have a dialogue, start a dialogue. And so that's what we've been doing for almost 4 years now. And, and you know, fortunately, the timing is such that we have access, the technology has matured to the point with the web and with social media that allows us to, you know, without too much difficulty, rather effortlessly, in fact, if we implement it correctly, to bring people together from all over the world. You know, all they need is a computer and access to the internet, and they can participate in our learning communities that HEDL has started. And so in our largest discussion group, we have almost 30,000 educators, most of them teachers and faculty. You know, probably 85%, you know, are teachers, professors, and faculty in general. And we have, you know, very robust professional, but very robust dialogue on any topic imaginable, you know, within teaching, learning, and education. And so, you know, we've had, you know, wonderful success in bringing educators together, because it doesn't we've removed the barriers. You know, that's one of the nice, you know, things about technology. If it's used properly, it can remove or at least minimize, you know, the barriers to access, you know, geographical barriers, political barriers, et cetera, and cost barriers. Because the platforms that we use are free for people. It doesn't cost them anything. You know, we just want, you know, educators to join, be part of the discussion, be part of the dialogue, and together talk about these issues and take responsibility as a profession, you know, to come together and have a dialogue and you know, to shift the paradigm collectively. As a group. And it just so happened that as we started to do that and started having all of these dialogues about how to improve education, how to improve teaching, how to improve learning in the modern era, how do we modernize, you know, the educational process and teaching and learning, that the idea came, you know, hey, we should have, you know, conduct a really in-depth, you know, research into this and produce a book so that we can articulate, you know, all of this that is coming out of these hundreds of discussions that are taking place, you know. And so that's how that idea got started. And, you know, and so we're able to, the outcome of that, you know, of course, is the book. You know, so it's been very much a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach. Not a legislative approach, not because we're a nonpartisan group. And so it's been very much a grassroots, bottom-up effort of educators coming together on their own volition because they are sincerely and genuinely interested in improving education and teaching and learning, one, to make their lives better and to make their students' lives better, to make the whole process more enjoyable and more meaningful. There's no reason why we have to be stuck in old paradigms and do things just because, well, that's the way we've always done it. You know,
right.
If we did that, progress would never take place. We'd still be living back in the Stone Age. But fortunately, humans are not wired that way. There is something in humans that want to learn, that because it's a built-in curiosity. Curiosity and creativity is a part of the human nature and the human psyche. Unfortunately, you know, I think oftentimes, you know, that is stifled, you know, in certain educational environments. And what we want to do is unstifle that, you know, release that curiosity, release that creativity, and put learning and inquiry, you know, at the center of the educational process, so that it's meaningful for people personally, meaningful, and it's, and just for no other reason, it's more effective, you know, in terms of students learning, you know, what they're expected to learn. You know, it's more effective. All the research shows that. Over the last 100 years, we've had so much research and so many learning theories being developed. And so these learning theories and this learning research has evolved very, very, very fast over the last 100 years. And now it's pointing, you know, to in a direction where the focus, you know, all of it's telling us that the focus should be on learning as an outcome, learning as a process. The learners need to be engaged in what they're doing. It needs to be personally meaningful for them. It needs to be fun and interesting for them, and they need to be active participants in the process. And that's not only beneficial as they're going through school, whether it's at the K-12 level or at the higher ed level, but we want to, that helps facilitate a situation where they start on the track of becoming lifelong learners, because we're in an age right now in 2013 where, you know, it's a knowledge intensive society, and so much of what we do is knowledge based and creativity based and relationship based. So you talk about the three R's, and, you know, now there's another set of three R's to go along with the original three R's, you know, relationships, you know, being one of them. But how do we produce lifelong learners, so even after they graduate, they have the capacity and the motivation to want to keep on learning throughout the rest of their lives, because it's important to them and it's meaningful to them?
Well, I think that what you also do, and this is the beauty in your organization and in what you are doing, whether it's inviting educators to submit publications, to participate there into dialogue, when you start talking about it being 30,000 people, what is that really doing? Well, what I see is that you are availing an opportunity for educators, whether they be a kindergarten teacher or they're teaching higher ed. And we are all on this process of constantly we are lifelong learners. And far too often, we get caught up in the mechanisms of the day-to-day in our school system. And we forget that we are the front line. We are the educators. Yeah. We are also the lifelong learners. And we have an opportunity to model what that really looks like. And so you are providing...
Exactly.
You are providing for educators an opportunity to reclaim the professional standards and professional aspect of what it is to be an educator and what that role is. And so by being given a voice and being able to engage with each other, we are now no longer little autonomous islands unto ourselves, because that's the tendency of educators.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And so, you know, I really encourage our listeners to become involved, to find out what's going on. And you know, what are some of the ways that teachers can be a part of this process?
Well, you know, the main way is to get involved. You know, I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about, you know, in this interview, and is sort of the central theme of the book, is how do we get learners involved? You know, and when we say learners, it usually implies the students, right? But teachers are learners also. because we're all learning. So we're all learners. Teachers are learners. Students are learners. And so and that brings us back to, you know, what is or should be the fundamental, you know, purpose, you know, of education. You know, it's learning. The ultimate purpose is to produce learning. Because we often confuse the means with the outcome, you know. Learning is the outcome. Teaching is the means, you know, to help facilitate and produce that learning, you know, as an outcome. Research, if you're in higher ed, you know, research, ultimately the ultimate purpose of research also is to produce learning. You know, what can we learn about, you know, this thing we're researching? So we keep coming back again and again to, you know, having learning as the sun, you know, learning and inquiry and discovery, you know, at the center of the educational process, you know. And so, you know, so teachers are constantly learning also. The best, you know, perhaps, you know, the way to start sort of that mind shift, you know, is to get involved, is to get engaged. And that takes an act of courage, you know, because, you know, maybe there's not, especially if the reward system is such that it doesn't reward being innovative or taking, you know, reasonable risk or trying new things. So, you know, it may involve an act of courage to sort of step out of our, you know, traditional way of doing things and get involved with, you know, with what's, with the new developments that are going on and getting engaged. But I would encourage anyone who is in the field of education, regardless of what level, regardless of your capacity, I extend an open invitation to, you know, to join our group on LinkedIn, you know, which is our main discussion group, a higher education teaching learning group on LinkedIn. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, you know, the common social media channels. But definitely, you know, join us on LinkedIn and be part of the discussion, you know, part of the collective, you know, discussion and inquiry. One of the wonderful, you know, just to give you an example, one of the wonderful things that is happening right now, both at the K-12 level and at the higher ed level, is this thing called learning communities. At the higher ed level, it's called faculty learning communities. At the K-12 level, it's called the professional learning communities. But I'm doing, you know, I'm in New York. I live in Queens, which is the western tip of Long Island. I've had a chance here recently to do some work with some of the high schools in Long Island here, eastern Long Island. And one school in particular is doing wonderful things with learning communities, professional learning communities. About 2.5 years ago, the school and the principal in particular, who was, you know, taking the leadership role in driving the initiative, decided, there's some wonderful things, you know, happening with the use of learning, professional learning communities at the high school. I want our, you know, school to try that. And so they developed a professional learning community for their teachers about 2.5 years ago. I had an opportunity to sit in on some of their meetings, and it's become very successful because the whole idea of professional learning communities is for the teachers to come together in a collegial way and to discuss ways and to dialogue about ways of how they can improve learning. And so in implementing professional learning community at that particular high school, they had to make a mind shift. And the mind shift was that the focus should be on what the student is learning and not so much on what the teacher is teaching. Because even the best teaching cannot ensure learning in the students if the learner is passive and is not actively, you know, participate in the learning process. So the focus shifts from what the teacher is teaching to what the learner is learning. You know, and so the whole focus, therefore, becomes on learning, you know, and how do we improve learning? both as an outcome and as a process. And that, and teachers, so in forming this professional learning community, get together regularly, you know, in regular meetings and discuss, you know, hey, you know, this is what I'm experiencing in my class. What are you experiencing the same things at your class? They look at the data. So it's very data-driven and research-based. And with the whole goal of how do we improve the learning process? How do we get learners to, increasingly take more responsibility for their own learning? So we start them down the path of becoming lifelong learners, where they're not, you know, totally dependent on us. They're not, you know, we're no longer in the spoon-feeding mode of just dispensing information, you know, the same way, but we've, you know, shifted things, you know, it starts with a mind shift, okay, and a different perspective and an understanding of really what is the ultimate purpose of education. And then when you do that, you realize, you know, we need to change some things, you know, so the focus is on learning and how do we get them involved, more actively involved, take more responsibility for that. Well, you do that in a number of ways, but one, it has to be meaningful. That's the most fundamental. It has to be interesting, it has to be meaningful, it has to be done in such a way with learning activities that are appropriate to the learning outcomes you want to achieve, and do it in a way that's interesting, that's engaging, and that's personally meaningful. And so that's one concrete example of what some schools are doing. Faculty in particular, teachers in particular, are doing to drive that process themselves, you know, and take more ownership and more responsibility for making that paradigm shift.
Yeah, I was involved in the district that I work with is very involved in the professional learning communities. And it has, you know, in some of the schools, especially in the elementary, middle schools, there has been some substantial changes and a greater understanding, you know, of student engagement. And we're seeing more and more teachers who are becoming, you know, true professionals leaders. Leaders are emerging in their learning communities because they're being given a voice through a professional learning community. And one of the questions that, you know, I'm going to ask, because I know that a lot of our listening audience are wondering this. What is the purpose of education? And I mean, I can tell you what I think my purpose or what I believe, but from what your research and what you have explored, how can you summarize what the purpose of education is?
Well, in one sense, education has multiple purposes, you know. Because it hopes to achieve, perhaps, you know, multiple aims. You know, maybe the aim is to, or the purpose is to produce lifelong learners. Maybe the aim is to produce graduates who can find employment, so they have the skills and the knowledge necessary to function, you know, in a modern knowledge-intensive, you know, based society and economy. Uh-huh. So, you know, one can make an argument that education serves multiple purposes. Another purpose, you know, would be, you know, it's part, especially at the K-12 level, it's to, transmit the cultural values of one generation to the next generation. And that's important, especially in the early years, in, you know, grades 1 through 5 or 6, you know, to learn, there's a very much, you know, in primary school, a cultural, sociocultural aspect to education, you know, and what are the values of the community, and what is important to us. In other words, what is important to us? when I say value, I mean, you know, importance. What is the importance to us as a society and a community that we want to instill in our children, you know? And so there's that purpose also. And I'm fine with all of that. You know, I think there are multiple purposes. But I think, you know, in the final analysis, the one common denominator that you see at all levels of education, whether it's in kindergarten or the eighth grade or high school or university or, you know, post, you know, professional, you know, school, medicine, law, whatever, or vocational schools, the one common denominator that they all have in common is the idea of learning. You know, the purpose, regardless of what level you're at, regardless of what institutional type it is, and the nature of the education, whether it's science education or humanities education or art or vocational or professional, you know, preparation, learning is the common denominator, you know, through all of those. That is the one purpose that is common to any educational enterprise or endeavor. And so that's why, you know, I like the idea of the focus of education being on learning, you know, a learning-centered environment, educational institution as a learning organization, as a learning community. And they're also part of a wider learning community within the educational profession and the teaching profession. And so I think, you know, that is part of the mind shift, you know, that has to occur if we want to improve learning, improve academic achievement, make learning more meaningful and more personally meaningful and interesting and engaging to everyone involved, not just for the students, but for the teachers also. Because the teacher's role shifts from being simply a content, you know, expert, a subject matter specialist, to one of being an instructional leader. And that, you know, is a definite shift, a mind shift. So the instructor, the teacher, professor, regardless of what level they're at, now assumes the role of instructional leader and learning architect and learning designer. Okay, how do I take this course that I'm responsible for? Okay, I already know the content because that's, you know, that's required. That's, you know, that's a basic requirement for the job. But how do I translate that, okay, into an effective learning environment? And right. To do that, you have to take on more of a role as an instructional leader and a learning architect. How do I design this course that's part of a larger program that's also part of the institution, you know, which has its own mission, you know, and values and organizational culture and all these other variables that are involved? But how do I design this as an instructional leader and learning architect so that we can produce effective learning in the students and thereby make it more meaningful, interesting, engaging, and thereby improve the effectiveness of the learning that's going on and improve the educational outcomes and the learning outcomes also?
Well, I almost wonder if we're moving into a place where we begin to identify our schools instead of calling them schools, because schools has a connotation. I mean, titles have a tendency to translate a degree of meaning. And so are we moving into a time now where instead of a school district, we should be called, for example, Michigan City Learning Community. And in these community are these different centers of learning, as opposed to here's the middle school, you know, instead of Michigan City High School, this is Michigan City secondary learning center, or, you know, and I know, you know, just because we need to begin to dispel the old standard myth and fear that goes with going to school. You know, we've lost sight of what our learning centers are. They are a place for learning. They're a place for, and maybe if we've gone to the point of now establishing professional learning communities in some of our schools, I think it's, I think it should be a norm. I think that it's very important that we are allowed to have opportunities and are encouraged to enter into think tanks, educational think tanks, if you will. You know, so I'm wondering if we are moving into the point where, you know, we need to dispel that old way and that old concept, even fear by so many of our parents. A lot of our kids come from homes where parents fear school. So how can we, you know, to move to the point where we begin to translate that into a language which represents, this is what you do when you are here. It's not a babysitting center or, you know, all those those negatives that go with school, because that's not what it is. And, on you know, by and large, that's really not what our learning centers are. But there's that there's those misconceptions out there which have kind of, it's like a fog. You know, we're trying, we know there's something there, but we can't really see it because it's not cleared up yet somehow.
Well, you know, maybe the language does need to change, you know, and I'm certainly okay with, you know, if that were to occur, you know, I think it would help as long as people had, you know, a good understanding of the definition, you know, of those terms. And so, but ultimately, you know, because language is very important. You know, it's critically important because a lot of our you know, the meanings we associate with different things in our lives, you know, come by the way of language, you know, and words. And so, language is powerful. Words is powerful. It's enormously powerful for both good or bad, you know. But how do we make it an instrument for good, you know? And you know, I think there probably will have to be some, you know, a new language, you know, at least some new terms that will emerge, you know, from, you know, from this paradigm shift to give us, you know, a better vocabulary. You know, for what we're, you know, engaged in, you know, in the educational process.
Exactly.
But ultimately, there has to be a mind shift, you know. There has to be a mind shift and an attitudinal shift that recognizes, you know, what are we in this for? You know, what is the ultimate purpose of why we're here, you know? What is our vision, you know, of what we're trying to, do we even have a vision? You know, do we even know what that vision is? Do we even know why we're here and the purpose of our existence, you know, as a profession and as an organization? You know, these are really fundamental, you know, questions, but they're critically important, because if we don't even have a sense of, you know, why we're here, you know, what is our mission, you know, and our vision that we're trying to achieve, what is the ultimate purpose of what we're engaged in, then I'm not even sure if a new language would help, you know. But certainly if we can, you know, start that mind shift so we can look at it from a different perspective and, you know, recognize that, okay, if we can all agree that, you know, it's that we want to, regardless of the reasons, but if we can all agree that we want to improve academic achievement in students, you know, because we want them to be better workers, you know, when they go into the workforce, or because we want them to start down the road of being a lifelong learner, you know, after they graduate, or because, you know, for in a democratic society, we want them to be more informed and engaged in participatory citizens, you know, in the democratic process. And those are all valid, you know, purposes also. So we may come at it from a different perspective, you know, and we may put more importance on this purpose, you know, versus this purpose, you know, citizenship versus, you know, better, you know, capable workers, you know, or more, you know, lifelong, you know, learners, et cetera. But the, again, you know, I keep coming back to the, what's the one common denominator? What's the one common theme that traverses all of those, okay? And that's the idea of learning, you know?
Right.
Because, you know, whether your aim is to produce a better citizen, better citizenship, or a better, you know, worker in the economy, or a lifelong learner, or just education for education's sake to produce more enlightened, you know, people, the one common denominator is the idea of learning, because they all require that, you know, the learning that is supposed to be going on is effective, you know,
right.
That it's actually producing, that the educational process is actually producing learning as an outcome and learning as a process. And so the shift, you know, moves away from solely what's being taught, you know, just the mechanics of what's being taught, to what's being learned, what's actually being learned, you know, by students, and how do we assess that? And equally as important as the assessment of it is how do we make the learning process more interesting and engaging and personally meaningful for students. So it's actually enjoyable, you know.
Right.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you have to ask yourself the question, you know, why are we doing this if it's not enjoyable?
Exactly.
You know, that seems to be a huge burden, you know, a very onerous burden we place on ourselves, both as administrators and teachers and students, if we're engaged in something as so that requires so much time and effort, you know, on a daily basis, if it's not enjoyable, you know,
right.
At the same time. So there's no reason, absolutely no reason, if we do it properly and appropriately, why education and learning in particular cannot be effective and interesting and engaging and meaningful at the same time.
One of the things that I really, I've said this over and over again, if most people who are in the corporate world had to spend every single day the way that most of us in education, whether we are the learner sitting in the classroom or the teacher in most of our schools, they would quit. They would reform it. No, they wouldn't reform it. They would transform it in a heartbeat because they would not continue to go to that, in many cases, toxic environment day after day after day. And, you know, it was interesting because as you were talking, as I'm thinking about, you know, this, I've talked a lot with other people about the agility and transforming education so that it is a place where kids play at becoming adults. By way of learning, and that's what the it's kind of a center to one of my themes. But so I started looking. You said something about vision, and I thought, what is the vision of my area school? I went to their website. I couldn't find it anywhere on their website.
Not a
good sign. Went to so I Googled it. I found another school, and this is the first one that came up. And let's try to identify where we find learning anywhere in this vision for this highly qualified school district. Our vision is a community that engages, educates, and empowers all to excel. Our mission, to deliver a world-class education promoting the highest level of academic achievement, creativity, personal growth that will inspire greatness in today's student and tomorrow's leader. Engage, educate, and empower every student every day.
Yeah.
And the values, excellence. We strive for unsurpassed achievement, challenging students to reach their personal best. How? That's my question. How? Collaboration. We work together and partner with our community, united by shared responsibility to educate our students.
Mm-hmm.
How? And then again, it goes on to talk about leadership, character, and creativity. These are all wonderful and well, and they're nice slogans, they're nice taglines, but how does that make a learning community? These sound like a military camp. This is what we begin. These are our future leaders, and they're going to learn how to walk in pace and strive. And I'm not criticizing them. They've got a great school. They're doing great. But in changing and transforming our education, because that's what you're talking about. You're talking about abandoning to a great regard those things, those notions, those approaches, those institutions that we at one time were beholden to because it worked. And in this ever-changing society, and you know, I have a question for you. I know we're running out of time. How do you define a 21st century learner?
Well, I think ultimately, it helps if one has an understanding of, you know, basic human nature and the human psyche and sort of what motivates most people, what defines a human being, you know. And we try to do some of that in the book, you know. And, of course, you know, in the last century or so, the whole field of, you know, psychology, you know, has developed in all the different branches of psychology to try to help explain what are people all about, what makes us tick, what motivates us, you know. And I think, you know, it might be, and of course people, you know, are different, you know. We have some commonalities, but we're also very different, you know, whether we're male, female, or just different personalities, you know. And if you've ever taken the Myers-Briggs type indicator test, you know, which is a pretty solid, you know, type of personality test because it's had many, many, many millions of people taking it. So it's a pretty valid, you know, and reliable test that has been refined over the years. And based on the work that Carl Jung did, you know, starting out, you know, at least the first two measures of the indicator test, and extrovert versus introvert, and sensing versus intuitive, you know, those sort of. So people have, you know, and that's a measure of preferences, you know, what we prefer to do, you know, and how we process, how we view the world, how we take in information, and how we process information, you know. For example, whether we, you know, get our energy, you know, internally or externally, you know, and what drives us, you know, where we get our energy from, that defines the first, you know, one, whether we're, you know, more introverted or extroverted, and how we process information, you know, whether we do it intuitively or, you know, through our senses, you know, primarily. And so, you know, people have different personalities, you know, so there is a lot of variability, you know, in people also, you know, that we should be, you know, aware of and cognizant of when we're thinking about, you know, all of these issues. And that's why I don't think, you know, that's why I try not to be prescriptive, you know, about, you know, what the solutions are, because because there is no one size that fits all. So much
right.
of this is contextually embedded. You know, it's contextually embedded, you know, at the social level, you know, within the community and the culture, you know, of the community, at the organizational level and what the organization is about, the type of organization, et cetera, and what they see as their, you know, primary purpose and mission, you know, as an organization, down to the individual level, the group level
right.
and the individual level, you know, right on down to the individual teacher and the individual students and the relationships, you know, between teacher and students and the nature of the course, you know, also in,
sure.
in the curriculum. And so, that's why I like the idea of teacher, you know, as learning architect and as instructional
mm-hmm.
leader, you know,
right.
because part of that implies that the teacher, regardless of the level and regardless of the course, is going to take a more sophisticated view, you know, and a more contextual understanding of the educational process for that particular course. And
right.
how do I design this in such a way that it's appropriate, you know, to these, you know, to the context that I find myself in, you know, and to the needs of the students, you know, and what students need. And the level of the students and their abilities and et cetera. And so that's why I don't think, you know, it would be too helpful, you know, to be too prescriptive, you know, on that because,
yeah.
You know, it has to, that really has to, and that's why I like the idea of learning communities, professional learning communities, because it fits in nicely with that whole notion of teachers coming together as a bona fide professionals.
Absolutely.
Who have, you know, are taking responsibility, you know, to transform, you know, the process, to move away from passivity and disengagement and move and shift the paradigm and move towards an environment that is engaging and interactive and active and meaningful for everyone involved. And so in doing that, I would think that there is a much higher likelihood that the whole process and just what we do at a practical level and on a daily basis, you know, would become more meaningful to everyone, not just the students, mm-hmm. you know, but the teachers and administrators and everyone who's involved in the process. But it
well,
starts
Pat,
with...
Patrick, unfortunately, we've got 30 seconds, so we get going, don't we? This is great. So should we have a part three?
well, I'm up for it. You are.
I'm wide. I am definitely up for it. I could talk to you at least. We could have our educational talks once a month. This has been wonderful talking with you, and I will, you know, encourage all of our listeners to, you know, access Meaning Center Education. It can be ordered through the HETL, HETL.org. Get your own copy. Educators, you need this. Parents, you should be reading this too. And thank you so much for being with us today. And we will talk again real soon, Patrick. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye.
All right. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
Okay, too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for stopping by Archie's Diner Radio, the voice of ArchiesDiner.com. Archie's Diner Radio is an Archie's production. Champagne and LaLuna production team featuring creator, executive producer Mary E. LaLuna, and Steve Champagne, producer, sound engineer, and artistic contributor.